Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the technical error that halted trading on the New York Stock Exchange, which is not being attributed to a cyber attack, but is being called a reported issue with Gateway Connection. Wall Street veteran William Cohan, a contributing editor to Vanity Fair who writes a bi-weekly opinion column for the New York Times and is the author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, joins us to discuss how unnamed technical issues shut down the stock exchange, grounded United Airlines, and crashed the Wall Street Journal's homepage all in the same day. Then we will speak with Harry Konstantinidis, who teaches economics at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He joins us to discuss the narrow window of time the Greek government has to end the debt crisis following Prime Minister Alex Tsipras' promise that his government will submit credible reform proposals on Thursday's deadline set by European leaders. Then finally, on the 20th anniversary of the massacre of 8,000 Muslim boys and men at Srebrenica in Bosnia, we will look into Russia's veto of a UN Security Council resolution condemning the worst atrocity in Europe since World War II as a crime of genocide. John Quigley, a professor emeritus of law at Ohio State University, who was a research scholar at Moscow State University, joins us to discuss why Russia, which suffered so much at the hands of the genocidal Nazis, felt it necessary to veto the crime of genocide resolution. And joining us now is William Cohan, a former senior Wall Street investment banker for 17 years at Lazard, Frere & Company, Merrill Lynch, and J.P. Morgan Chase, as well as a New York Times bestselling author whose books include Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, and The Last Tycoons, The Secret History of Lazard, Frere & Company. He is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and writes a bi-weekly opinion column at the New York Times, and his latest book is The Price of Silence. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Cohan.
Thank you, Ian. Always nice to be here.
And, well, it's not nice to have your wealth tied up on the New York Stock Exchange if they close it down for very unspecified technical reasons. And the best that they've been able to say is that it was a problem with gateway connections. They've gone out of the way to say it's not a cyber attack. What do you make of it?
Well, I mean, sometimes, Ian, I think you need to sort of count the blessings where you've got them. I mean, the good news is it was not a cyber attack. It was not a terrorist attack. It was not somehow related to the collapse of the Chinese stock market or Greece's default on 315 billion euros of debt. It seems like it's just sort of a human error, you know, that's being blamed on technical errors, which I guess in this day and age where there are no longer any actual traders down on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange and it's all down now done electronically, you know, we're going to have to get used to this happening more and more.
Well, it's not just the New York Stock Exchange. Unspecified technical issues have grounded United Airlines and the Wall Street Journal's homepage crashed all on the same day.
Yes, and again, at the moment, it's tempting to think that there might be linkage between these things. It's tempting to worry about whether it's some sort of coordinated cyber attack. We've certainly seen a lot of cyber attack activity. It's certainly something that everybody, CEOs of businesses all across the country worry, and they say that it's their sort of number one concern. It's possible at the moment that there are sort of independent glitches, each and every one, but we'll just have to see whether there's anything coordinated about it, which would, of course, be much more concerning.
So to the broader issues, then, of why do you think, William Cohan, so much of our attention has been on Greece, which is an economy the size of Louisiana's, and so little attention has been paid to China, which is the second biggest economy in the world? Its stock market has been in free fall now for the last 3 weeks, and now it's reached a point where it's apparent that the Chinese government simply can't control its own economy. And it's, you know, cut interest rates, prevented any new IPOs from coming on, and arranged a $19 billion fund from brokerage houses to, and all this has done is had a slight slowdown in the sell-off, But the sell-off continues. It's affected the Japanese stock market as well. And it's also got, I think, a lot of big U.S. corporations like GM that are heavily invested in Chinese consumers worried.
Well, Ian, I hope this isn't too counterintuitive or too much for your listeners to grapple with, but I actually think it's a good thing. I think that the Chinese stock market was incredibly overvalued, overpriced. Even though it's fallen for the last 3 weeks and is down whatever, something like 40 or 50% at this point, it's still up for the year. It was highly overinflated. You know, frankly, it's not dissimilar to what's been going on in Silicon Valley with companies like Uber and Twitter and Facebook and Google that are just have these massive valuations that don't really seem to have much basis in financial fact. What happens is that people just get really carried away, and they think that what has gone, if it's gone up, 100% in a year, it's going to keep going up. And that kind of euphoria, that sort of senseless euphoria, is not a good thing for rational investing. It's not a good thing for long-term wealth creation. It's not a good thing for long-term investors. It attracts speculators, and that's not a good thing at all. And my counter belief is that when there is a collapse of this nature and it's ongoing and it doesn't seem to be able to be stemmed, I think that's actually a good thing because it drives out the speculators. It forces them to realize big losses. People who have bought stock on margin, people who've speculated by buying into companies that have no financial record of any of sort, which is, apparently something that happens occasionally in this country and now seems to be rampant in China. I think this is all a good thing because, you cannot have a market as overinflated and with so many speculators in it as it was going in China to persist. So whereas when it comes to China, I think this is a good thing. Why people have not focused more on it, I think it's the simple fact that not many Americans are invested in China. Not many Americans understand the Chinese stock market or care to understand the Chinese stock market. And, I think there's probably an element of schadenfreude that this is our sort of major economic rival in the world. And if they're having a difficult time in their stock market, well, good. Their losses are gain kind of thing. So I think that's the logic with regard to China. With regard to Greece, I mean, yes, Greece may be an economy the size of Louisiana, but what you're talking about here is something much larger, which is, is this going to precipitate the unwinding of the Eurozone and the unwinding of the euro as a viable currency? It wasn't so long ago that we were talking about the euro as sort of a serious rival to the dollar and replacing the dollar as a standard currency around the world. And now we're talking about potentially the breakup of the Eurozone or serious wound to the viability of the Eurozone. And I think that is the kind, it's not Greece per se, or even the Greek creditors, €315 billion is a lot to think about, but it's Puerto Rico has $75 billion of debt that's defaulting to, or looks like it might default, and we don't seem to be getting bent out of shape about that. I think what the bigger issue here is what this might mean for the Eurozone and the euro as a currency.
And again, I'm speaking with William Cohan, as a former senior Wall Street investment banker for 17 years at Lazard Frere & Company, Merrill Lynch, and J.P. Morgan Chase, as well as a New York Times bestselling author, whose books include Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, and The Last Tycoons, The Secret History of Lazard Frere & Company. He is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and writes a biweekly opinion column at The New York Times. And his latest book is the price of silence. Of course, though, just as a comparison between the Eurozone debt that Greece has and what's being lost on the Chinese stock market, the Chinese companies, there's about $3 trillion in value that's just evaporated, which, of course, is about, what, 20 times what we're talking about in terms of Greece. And the curious thing is that this has all been encouraged by the government, who attempted to shift economic power from state-owned enterprises to the private sector and encouraged people, just regular Chinese people, to borrow money to buy shares on margin, which is extraordinary. And of course, it has echoes of what happened in 1929 in the Roaring Twenties with the Wall Street crash. That's obviously a recipe for disaster, isn't it, Bill? When you've got the Chinese who've come out of a communist system, they've now got this wild west of capitalism. You can't expect ordinary Chinese, you know, investors to be sophisticated.
Yes, I think that's very true, Ian. And the government has encouraged a lot of, you know, middle-class Chinese to buy stocks on margin. You know, I was hearing a story yesterday about, you know, a Chinese a guy who made all this money in the stock market and then turned around and made a loan to his brother-in-law so that he could buy a new car. I mean, you know, everybody, when it looks like a tree can grow to the sky, and you know, taxi drivers are starting to talk about investing in A rounds or B rounds of venture capital companies, or you know, people who with not enough money to lose are starting to invest in these kind of roaring markets, then that is always a danger sign, and the professionals, you know, see that coming and are generally smart enough to get out of the way. But it's unconscionable for the Chinese government to have encouraged its people to invest in the stock market in this way, and it's unconscionable for them to sort of allow companies that don't have much financial wherewithal to be listed on these stock exchanges and to go public in the first place. So, I mean, there needs to be, as you know, as we found out in 1929, there needs to be a real serious regulation. There needs to be people who are cops on the beat watching that this doesn't happen. You know, we know that now, sort of, you know, 80 plus years after the crash in 1929, we know that unfortunately some of our cops on the beat are corrupted, whether they be at the SEC or the Fed or the Justice Department when it comes to monitoring Wall Street bad behavior. But, you know, this is unfortunately always a learning process, and people have to get really burned before they understand that they can also lose money in the stock market as well as make money in the stock market. And, you know, again, I think this is a good thing. It's not a bad thing. What's a bad thing is when these markets get overinflated and there's no visible means of support for these valuations, and the valuations do not make any sense compared to the financial performance of these companies. And I think very much that's what you see happened in China. And frankly, it's what you see happening in Silicon Valley with a lot of these private venture-backed companies that have no visible means of support. I mean, you know, Uber at $40 billion just does not make any sense. It's a taxi company, you know, in many different cities around the country and the world. Good for it, but $40 billion valuation makes no sense.
Well, of course, the Chinese stock market that we're talking about is contained within China. It doesn't trade anywhere else, and it's not a part of an international trading system. But how's this affecting, you know, there are a few big Chinese companies on the New York Stock Exchange, which is where our conversation began, because it's been shut down today for reasons that still haven't been explained. So how is this affecting Baidu and Alibaba and these big Chinese companies that are trading on the U.S. exchanges?
Well, again, hopefully it is taking some of the air out of their bubble, because that's the more important long-term trend that needs to go on here. These companies were all overpriced. They were well beyond their earnings stream or their earnings capabilities in the near term. And so, again, I think it's a good thing whether they're traded on the New York Stock Exchange or whether they're traded on the Chinese Stock Exchange, to me, taking a lot of air out of this Chinese bubble is going to be good in the long run for not only the companies, but for investors, and to it sort of improve investor confidence in the reality of how markets work. And, you know, I think that while, for instance, our market is trading at or near all-time highs, and it's more than, it's almost tripled, you know, since its March 2009 lows, I actually think in our market, corporate profits that are at an all-time high, corporate cash on the balance sheets is an all-time high. Actually, in our market, even though the prices are high and the market's at an all-time high, I think that there's actually a lot more rationality going on in our market, which I think is a result of what happened in 2008. And I think that makes a lot of sense. That's very positive for investors. And I think, you know, that's why you don't see any kind of overreaction in our market, despite the fact that there was this glitch in the New York Stock Exchange today. It, by the way, it has just now resumed trading, and we still don't know why it's happened, and they better have some good explanation. But, you know, I view what's going on in China as healthy. I don't understand the glitch in the stock market today. As far as Greece, what I don't understand about that, Ian, is that companies all over the world are allowed to restructure their debts. Amend and extend is a phrase that's used on Wall Street. Why can't Greece amend and extend its maturities and just reach a settlement with its creditors and go on to fight another day? It's frankly, it's become way too political and way too much of a showdown. This should have been just done, you know, relatively simple. People biting the bullet, admit that they made a bad investment by buying this Greek debt and move on, just like companies do all the time, every day.
Well, you just mentioned that corporate profits are at an all-time high and that the stock market is huge. It's tripled since 2009. All this under a socialist president? what do you make of that?
Yeah, well, you know, Wall Street loves to blame Obama for all the things that have gone wrong, but interest rates have never been lower. People who make money from money have never made more money than ever before. The stock market's at an all-time high. The wealth that's been created by the top 1% and the top 1% of the 1% has never been more. I mean, President Obama has done more for the wealthy in this country than any other previous president, you know, in a very long time. So I just find it utterly ironic that the 1% complain when the 1% have gotten even richer under Obama than they ever could have hoped for because of the Fed's low interest rate policies and the booming stock market, which has been a boon to anybody who invests in private equity, anybody who's a hedge fund manager who knows what they're doing. And, you know, it's been fortunes have been made in the stock market, you know, tripling from March 2009 to now. You know, with basically the expanse of the Obama presidency, the likes of which have never been made before. And so the 1% should be down on their knees thanking President Obama every day. But, of course, that runs counter to their narrative, and so they won't do it.
Well, it's not that they complain about him. A lot of them hate him. It's pretty surreal. But just in the last minute or so, William Cohan, if the Chinese economy slows, which it was slowing in any case, and now it's taking a hit because of the bubble bursting on the stock market, and we don't know where that's going to end up, but surely big U.S. companies like General Motors that are heavily invested in the growing Chinese market for sales, as are, by the way, the here in Hollywood, of course, one of the big beneficiaries of China's growing economy has been Hollywood movies. That's why they make these cartoons today that don't rely on characters and dialogue. They're just all about special effects. So what's your final word on that? Because it is going to have an effect, isn't it?
Of course it will have an effect on companies that do business with China, because if there's less of the incredible wealth that was created in China over the last, you know, 10, 15 years, then that's going to affect U.S. companies that sell to China. And if people are feeling poorer because their wealth was evaporated in the last 2 weeks in the Chinese stock market, then of course they're going to be spending less on things like iPhones and Teslas and things that we make, that American companies make. But again, I think in the long run, it'll be a good thing. I think, again, the economy in China was probably overheated, probably at a level that was unsustainable. Again, it's not a market-driven economy in the way we think of our economy as market-driven. It is definitely a centrally planned economy, which is, great if you want to get things done. You don't have to get it through Congress. You don't have to get a spending program through Congress. If you want to do something, you get it done. That has been good for demand for goods and services worldwide, but I think also to some extent it's unsustainable. And I think now, again, lower growth in China is probably the more realistic level. And it's time that we sort of dial back our expectations of what China's growth will be like into a more realistic level. Again, I think it's all very good and long overdue as far as what's going on in China.
Well, William Cohen, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
And we've been speaking with William Cohen, a former senior Wall Street investment banker for 17 years at Lazard, Frere & Company, Merrill Lynch, and J.P. Morgan Chase, as well as a New York Times bestselling author whose books include Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, and The Last Tycoons, The Secret History of Lazard, Frere & Company. He is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and writes a bi-weekly opinion column at The New York Times, and his latest book is The Price of Silence. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into Greek Prime Minister Alex Tsipras' promise that his government will submit credible reform proposals on Thursday's deadline. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Harry Konstantinidis, who is an assistant professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Welcome to Background Briefing, Harry Konstantinidis.
Good to be with you.
And the European leaders have set Thursday as a deadline for serious reform plans from Greece in exchange for more aid. And Greek Prime Minister Alex Tsipras has promised his government will submit credible reform proposals to its creditors on Thursday, and then there's an emergency summit involving all 28 European Union members, which is more, of course, than the 19 Eurozone countries. And that's going to take place on Sunday. So things are coming to a crunch, I take it. What's your sense of whether we're going to avoid the worst here?
I think we've reached a point where there is certainly Greece fatigue, definitely in the international media, definitely among the negotiators. So it gets to the point where this protracted crisis should be resolved one way or another. So given the importance not so much of the Greek economy as much of the ability of the Eurozone to resolve issues like that, I think it's normal that the summit on Sunday is not just a summit of the Eurozone countries, but of all European Union countries. I think we are getting to the point where, especially given the strong mandate that the Greek government got from last week's referendum, I think we're getting to the point where the European leaders need to decide whether they want to resolve the Greek issue. A resolution that would be viable in most, at least in the eyes of the Greek government, would be a resolution that would involve a discussion of debt and the sustainability of debt. The IMF came out again today saying that we need to put debt restructuring on the table, and this is a position that is very close to what the Greek government has been saying for a while now, So I think that we're getting to the point where a solution to the Greek situation requires bold decisions on all sides and compromises on all sides.
So when you say, Harry Konstantinidis, that there is Greek fatigue, there is, of course, an obvious comparison where Greece has an economy the size of the state of Louisiana's, and China is the world's second biggest economy, and its stock market's been in free fall, and $3 trillion have been lost. And, of course, today the New York Stock Exchange crashed for unexplained reasons. So there's other things happening out there in the world. So do you think some proportionality has come into this?
I think at some point we need to realize that there is proportionality to this, right? I mean, if you think about it, how many days now we've been discussing the Greek situation, even though there may, you know, what is happening in China is certainly more important taken in proportion. So the fact that we have, and when I say we, I don't mean Greeks, I think that the fact that the European leaders have been dragging their feet for a while now, calls for action. I think that the Greek government has made a series of compromises. It has made a series of concessions. And I think that we have reached a point where something that should have been reasonable and something that should not have been taboo, like discussing the sustainability of debt, needs to come on the table. I mean, like, this is and it's also particularly interesting when you see different creditors, when you see the IMF talking about debt sustainability for a while now and having the debt sustainability assessment that was not released and was only released, at the objection of other Eurozone countries. So we've reached the point where we need to solve this problem so that we move on to other problems, the global economy, if you will. Having said that, there is clearly a failure of political imagination in Europe so far to find ways to tackle the problem. We have been sticking to a set of policies that have created the crisis, essentially. The debt-to-GDP ratio, when the structural adjustment program started in Greece in 2010, was 120% of GDP, and the debt-to-GDP ratio today is approximately 180% of GDP. So, to some extent, realizing that the road that we've taken does not lead us anywhere is a realization that the European leaders essentially and eventually have to come.
But it's obviously become too political, and two Nobel laureates in economics, Joe Stiglitz and Paul Krugman, pointed out that nothing that's happening between Greece and Europe makes any sense economically. It's become political. And our previous guest on today's program made the point, and he's a Wall Street veteran, made the point that companies and corporations are given leeway to amend and extend with financing to restructure their debts, and he doesn't understand why the same doesn't apply to the government of Greece. What would your answer be to that?
I agree with the statement. We have, again, as I said before, we have been looking at the crisis without pragmatism, and we have been applying moralistic ideas about what should be economic problems. The Greek government is only asking for something similar to what the German government got in 1953, to what the Polish government got in 1991, to what corporations and private firms get from their lenders when they are unable to pay their debt. This is pretty much a simple principle, but when you get to the point where you cannot pay your creditors, if I may add, partly because of the creditors are asking you to do things that jeopardize your ability to pay them back, then you come to the point where you have to figure out other ways of growing, which would allow you to then repay your creditors. Now, that requires a certain amount of flexibility, and that requires a realization and a coming to terms with the idea that your previous approach was not the correct approach. Especially for certain countries and certain governments and certain politicians in Europe, this also requires the acceptance of the fact that the austerity doctrine not only did not work, but also an acceptance and a public acceptance of the fact that it wasn't Greece that got bailed out in 2010. It was essentially German and French banks that were exposed to Greek government bonds. So this is not something that certain parties and certain politicians in Europe are willing to concede very easily, partly because they have spent the last 5 years telling their electorates that they bailed out Greek pensioners and that they bailed out the Greek government. So that would require a major retelling of the story that they were telling for the last 5 years, even though the story that they were telling for the last 5 years was not accurate. According to some estimations, only 90% of the loans that Greece got during the adjustment programs went back to creditors of Greece. So only an approximate 9%, if I'm not mistaken, went to Greece. So this is not the way that the Greek story has been told to German voters, to French voters, to Estonian voters, and that requires a certain amount of boldness in order to get the record straight.
Well, obviously, there's been the German voters who explain the reason why I think Angela Merkel is not particularly flexible is because they have bought into this false narrative that the southern Europeans are lazy and don't pay their taxes and are profligate when no mention is made of. And in fact, this is one of the great ironies of modern finance, that irresponsible lenders don't get punished, but irresponsible borrowers get punished. And in the case of the Syriza government, all of the borrowing is done by its previous governments. So it's all very hard to follow. But just in terms of the politics, so Alex Tsipras spoke to the European Parliament, where he mentioned that Greece would file new concrete proposals, credible reforms for a fair and viable solution. He also criticized the Europeans' bailouts that have turned Greece into what he calls an austerity laboratory. But he was greeted by boos and cheers. Many of the European parliamentarians were holding up no signs. But he was also criticized, along with being cheered, by a German member of the European Parliament who said, "The extremists of Europe are applauding you," referring to the fact that Tsipras was getting applause from both the left and the right being people like Nigel Farage of UKIP in the UK, who said the Greeks are brave people, and he advised Tsipras to seize the moment and lead them out of the single currency. And of course, we know that there's right-wing members from Hungary, and of course, the French right-wing did extremely well, came in second in the last parliament. So that's a little, I mean, you know, I'm at a left-wing radio station here in the United States, and most of our listeners see Greece as the victim and the Europeans as the bullies. But it's not quite that straightforward, is it? There is an element of Tsipras's own government, Syriza, is in coalition with a far right-wing government, isn't it?
Okay, let's unpack this. First of all, everything you're right about what happened today in the European Parliament, but there was one more thing that Tsipras said today, and I think this also tells us something about the boos and the cheers that took place at the Parliament today. Tsipras today said that essentially this fight and this conflict is not a conflict between nations, but it is a conflict that takes place along political and ideological lines, more or less, and we'll come back to that in a second. So if you look at the cheers and the boos, to some extent, I think that Tsipras had a very warm reception from, clearly from his own party, the party of the European left. He had a favorable reception from the Greens, and he had a generally positive, I would say, reception from the Social Democrats, not from the German Social Democrats, but definitely from the shed of the Social Democratic European Party, and then she had opposition from the Liberals and from Manfred Weber and the European People's Party. So, to some extent, we have the alignment of political forces in a way that makes sense thinking politically and thinking about the ideological spectrum. And then we have the Eurosceptics. Then we have people like Farage, then we have people like Le Pen, who are also who are trying to capitalize on this standoff that takes place along political lines and ideological and class lines, if I also may add, in order to try to benefit for their own nationalistic purposes. So the fact that Europe has proven incapable of like taking care of the Greek situation right now is a great opportunity for parties that feed on hatred and that feed on misanthropy, if I may say, in order to say, well, look at these Europeans, wouldn't you rather be outside Europe? And this is partly what Farage was telling Tsipras today, you know, like, why don't you exit? This is not the perspective that that Tsipras and that Syriza has been taking so far. Syriza is a pro-Europe party in the sense that it believes in European solidarity. It believes in a different type of Europe. Now, I think it's important to distinguish between the clash that takes place along political and ideological lines, and to separate from this clash, to separate from this conflict, the nationalists who are trying to benefit for their own purposes and are trying to, you know, point to the failures of the European Union in order to reproduce nationalism and to reproduce hatred. This is not what Syriza has been doing, and they've been trying to avoid this. Regarding the later part of your question, regarding the co-governing between Syriza and the independent Greeks, this was definitely a coalition that would not have happened under optimal situations. I think that Syriza and most of the Syriza voters would much rather govern with the Communist Party, for example, rather than govern with the independent Greeks. Having said that, I think that this is a coalition that is not going to last very long, but where there is clearly a major coalition partner and a minor coalition partner. So, for example, the minor coalition partner, the independent Greeks, may be unwilling to vote for some of the measures that Syriza has been proposing over the last few months. So Syriza was trying to extend citizenship to kids of immigrants in Greece, and the independent Greeks were not willing to vote for that. This still went through. So the extension of citizenship to more kids, to kids of immigrants who were born in Greece and raised in Greece, is a measure that Syriza is not going to shy away because of the minor coalition partner. Or same-sex civil union is something that Syriza has been pushing, and pushing successfully despite the objections of the minor coalition partner. I think that this is only a tactical coalition that is going to seize the moment that we reach a more viable and a more sustainable political scene in Greece. And I don't think that it is a coalition that has hurt Syriza in terms of like watering down what Syriza has wanted to do over the last 5 months.
And of course, there is a real fascist party in Greece, right? Golden Dawn, that's the complete antithesis of Syriza. Well, Harry Konstantinidis, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.
And we've been speaking with Harry Konstantinidis, who's an assistant professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into why Russia vetoed a UN resolution condemning a crime of genocide that took place 20 years ago when 8,000 Muslim boys and girls were massacred in Srebrenica.
Oh, I do believe if you don't like things you leave for some place you never gone before. Ba, 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 ba.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Quigley, who's a professor emeritus of law at Ohio State University and previously a research scholar at Moscow State University and a research associate in comparative law at Harvard Law School. He has dealt with conflicts between Ukraine and Russia after the breakup of the USSR on behalf of the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe, and his books include Basic Laws on the Structure of the Soviet State, Law After Revolution, and The Ruses for War, American Interventionism Since World War II. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Quigley.
Thank you very much.
And it's a little difficult to understand, it's not difficult to understand why Russia vetoed the UN resolution on Wednesday that would have condemned the 1995 massacre of Muslims at Srebrenica. 8,000 at least were murdered in what has been called a crime of genocide. So it sort of goes back to the bombing of Serbia, which apparently was something that alienated the Russians from the U.S. after that period of a thaw in the Cold War, after the Soviet Union collapsed. Relations with, or at least attitudes toward, that the Russians had towards America were extremely positive. But then after the bombing of Serbia, they soured, and they've obviously soured to a point where they're pretty much dysfunctional at the moment. So how do you explain Russian attitudes that they're solidarity with the Serbs is more important, apparently, than recognizing mass genocide, the worst since World War II, particularly given what Russia or what the Soviet Union suffered during World War II with 27 million killed at the hands of the genocidal Nazis?
Right. I think there are two aspects to this. I mean, one can talk about the draft resolution and the language of that draft resolution, which I think was one factor in the Soviet or the Russian veto. The other is to go back to what you're referring to, and that is the relationship between Russia and Serbia, and that does go back, I would say, at least to the Second World War, which you referred to. You referred to the Soviet losses in the Second World War. But during the Second World War, it was the Serbs who were fighting as partisans against Nazi Germany. And that was a very defining moment, I think, in terms of the Russian-Serb relationship, because the Russians, of course, were also fighting, well, both their army and as guerrillas, fighting against Germany. So they have a common history there of fighting against Germany in the Second World War, at a time when Croatia, for example, was in effect, taken over by the Nazis and was not doing that. So in terms of the Balkans, it was the Serbs that were the kind of bulwark against the German invasion. So you've got a history that goes back. There's also something which is probably relevant that goes back even farther, and that is religion, which is now making something of a resurgence, you might say, in Russia. And that is that the Serbs are Orthodox and the Russian are Orthodox. And that has been another source of tie between them, whereas the other ethnic groups in the Balkans, the Croats are Catholic, and the Bosniaks are Muslim. So you've got quite a bit going there. And as you mentioned as well, the bombing of Serbia in 1999, which Russia opposed, and that was an episode that. You know, one can argue both sides as to whether that was an appropriate thing. There's certainly a strong point of view that would hold that bombing never should have taken place. But that's all just to give a bit of an overview of the background of the relationship. Then you've got this resolution, which, as you say, would have characterized as genocide the events at Srebrenica in July of 1995. And there is certainly a solid basis for saying that genocide was committed there, in that it has been so decided by the International Court of Justice, it's been so decided by the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, and it certainly was the most significant mass killing that has taken place in Europe since the time of the Second World War. And I think that there's another aspect of it that probably plays into the draft resolution, and that is that the UN itself was, in a way, involved because it had set up Srebrenica as a safe area and had asked people to come in, told them that they could come into that area, that they would be protected. And they came in, and they were not protected. And there's been a great deal of soul-searching over that because it was a Dutch battalion that was supposed to be doing the protecting, and when it came to it, they allowed, you know, General Mladic to put people onto buses and cart them away for a fate that should have been obvious at the time. So the UN considers itself to be in part responsible for what happened at Srebrenica. But the particular draft resolution, I think, was problematic in that it not only characterized what happened at Srebrenica as genocide, but it also had a phrase saying that acceptance of the tragic events at Srebrenica as genocide is a prerequisite for reconciliation. And that suggests that anyone who doesn't think that it was genocide is kind of off the charts in terms of political reconciliation. And I think it was probably a mistake on the part of the UK to include that language. If they had just had a condemnation of what occurred there as genocide, I think they would have been in a stronger position. I mean, as it was, there were four other states that abstained in the Security Council. So it wasn't only, Russia was only the negative vote, but Angola, China, Nigeria, Venezuela all, you know, opted not to vote in favor of the resolution. And I think the fact that it included that phrase was probably a factor in their decision not to support it.
Yeah, well, indeed, Russia cast a veto, and there were the four abstentions, as you mentioned, China, Nigeria, Angola, and Venezuela, and the other 10 members of the Security Council voted in favor of the resolution. Again, I'm speaking with John Quigley, Professor Emeritus of Law at Ohio State University and previously a research scholar at Moscow State University and a research associate in comparative law at Harvard Law School. He has dealt with conflicts between Ukraine and Russia after the breakup of the USSR on behalf of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. And his books include Basic Laws on the Structures of the Soviet State, Law After Revolution, and The Ruses for War, American Interventionism Since World War II. But getting to the current dysfunctional relationship where apparently Putin and Obama used to speak quite often on the phone at length, now they virtually don't talk to each other, and there's been a clear effort to isolate Putin internationally, and at the G20 meeting, I think it was about a year ago, maybe, in Brisbane, Australia, Putin was ostracized. There's still ongoing efforts to investigate and cast responsibility for the shootdown of the Malaysian airliner. So there's a lot of outstanding issues between Russia and the US, but my understanding is that the goodwill that the Russian people felt towards the U.S. after the end of the Cold War did change at that moment when the U.S. bombed Serbia. And I'm trying to get an understanding of why that happened and what is so important in terms of the solidarity the Russians have towards the Serbs that would trump any sense of outrage about genocide. Because, you know, you mentioned World War II, and there's no question that the Serbs fought the Nazis and that the Croats collaborated with the Nazis, but also, you know, the US and the UK through the OSS, etc., did arm and support Tito as well. So what do you think is at the heart and soul of this beginning of the end of the brief romance between Russia and America after the Cold War ended?
Well, I mean, the bombing of Serbia would be one element, and that certainly did put Russia on the other side from not only the United States, but the Western European powers generally. I think that the general good feeling, as you described it, that developed after the breakup of the Soviet Union probably could have survived that. But I think it's been more recent events that have really brought the relationship down with this kind of escalation back and forth in relation to Ukraine.
Well, already that situation has reached a kind of standoff and a stalemate. And I was just reading stories today that Chechen rebels are now joining the fight with the Ukrainians, some of these Chechen rebels being sort of pretty hardcore Islamists. So the dimensions of the of that war, at least in that regard, are broadening. What's your sense of whether there will be a summer, an offensive? Obviously, this is the time, in terms of weather, when one would expect things to heat up. Do you think that's going to happen?
Well, the fighting certainly doesn't seem to be diminishing, and one would expect it to pick up over the summer months. And the introduction of the Chechens is to me a very unexpected element. Although it makes a certain amount of sense because they've been fighting against Russia, and that is to my mind something of a wild card, and makes it hard for me to predict exactly what's going to happen. I think that fact does make it more likely that there will be some uptick on the Ukraine government side, I'm not sure how that will play out.
But in terms of, we talked earlier about guerrilla warfare being a big factor in the war against the Nazis, and particularly in Yugoslavia and in Russia itself, what do you think is the sort of the calculus going on there in Putin's mind and in the mind of the Russian military? Obviously, the defense budget is going up. It's nowhere near where the U.S. is, but it's gone up sharply. And they are perfecting what they call a new kind of warfare that integrates cyber, propaganda, intelligence, and military action all together, kind of what they call hybrid warfare. But on the other hand, so far, you get this starting to get the feeling that the more that Russia pushes in terms of Novaya Russia, in terms of reestablishing the former Soviet Union, the more likely it is to create a kind of a guerrilla warfare backlash. And so in terms of the correlation of forces, do you think that at some point, my understanding is that Russia's finding it expensive to absorb both Crimea and the eastern parts of Ukraine that they've taken. So do you see, at the end of the day, a new form of asymmetrical warfare developing there?
I think, as you say, it is turning out to be rather costly for Russia, and that may, in the end, lead the Russian government to tone down its role. At the same time, I think there has been a certain effort at kind of a resurgence of dignity, you might say, because of the fact that with the breakup of the Soviet Union, Russia became immediately something of a second-rate country, and there's a certain amount of pride that goes into the policy that we've seen playing out over the last year or so in Ukraine. And I think Mr. Putin is finding that what he is doing is generally playing well domestically. But, you know, it has led to some hardship for the population, which works in the other direction. He's cut off, imports of food items from Western Europe, which is something that isn't very helpful for the population.
So just in closing then, is there a possibility of some kind of diplomatic resolution, or are we going to just sort of drift back into a kind of new Cold War over Ukraine?
Well, I think there is a possibility for a diplomatic resolution, because I think it's a difficult conflict for each side to sustain. Each has good reasons for wanting it to tone down. I think it would be helpful on the Western side if they could alter their view of what happened in Crimea, because I think Russia, views very strongly its role in Crimea as being one that was appropriate. And as long as that is a sticking point, it's going to be very difficult. Crimea was part of Russia for several hundred years, and there are good reasons why it makes sense for Crimea to be part of Russia. I don't, in fact, expect the Western countries to turn around in their view that Crimea represents simply a foreign invasion by Russia of the sovereign territory of Ukraine. So I'm not hopeful that there's going to be an alteration of the Western position on that front.
Well, John Quigley, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with John Quigley, Professor Emeritus of Law at Ohio State University and previously a research scholar at Moscow State University and a research associate on comparative law at Harvard Law School. He has dealt with conflicts between Ukraine and Russia after the breakup of the USSR on behalf of the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe. And his books include Basic Laws on the Structure of the Soviet State, Law After Revolution, and The Ruses for War, American Interventionism Since World War II. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.